This brings us to the time for our presentation, A Therapeutic Approach to Criminal Justice. And it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Jamie Struthers. Jamie is a lifelong member of the Regina Unitarian community. He has a law degree from the University of Saskatchewan and has been practicing law in southern Saskatchewan since 1984. He received his Queen's Counsel in 2005. Jamie was the legal director at Legal Aid Saskatchewan since 1995 and is currently the director of the Regina City office and has held that position since 2011. His practice areas are exclusively criminal justice and family justice. He is a member of the Regina Drug Treatment Court Governance Committee and the Regina Domestic Violence Court Operations Committee. Jamie?
Thank you very much. Is that on? Oh, there we are. Again, the topic today is a therapeutic approach to criminal justice. Again, as I was just pulling up here this morning, I realized that I'm making this presentation for those of you who have just come in from the parking lot and hearing Michael Enright interviewing Alyssa Siegel speaking on the Sunday edition about the Brampton Drug Treatment Court. And I guess there'll be a little bit more of the same this morning. I'll start with just a quote from Gilbert and Sullivan, the Mikado. "My object all sublime I shall achieve in time, to let the punishment fit the crime. The punishment fit the crime." This soliloquy uttered by the Lord High Executioner in Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado pretty much says it all when describing the conventional regime for sentencing of offenders in Canadian, U.S. and British criminal, in the Canadian, U.S. and British criminal justice system. I had originally thought that I would only address this gathering and speak only to the issue of domestic violence and our approach to it. It certainly is the largest specialty court in terms of numbers. However, on reflection, it occurred to me that this was but one case in which a more proactive and somewhat less punitive approach was being used to address particular situations. So back to the therapeutic approach to criminal justice. What is it, and how does it differ from the Lord High Execution, from that described by the Lord High Executioner? And what and are there examples of therapeutic justice in practice today? So we'll start very briefly. Section 718 of the Criminal Code of Canada basically sets forth what are the purpose and principles of sentencing. So it says the fundamental purpose of sentencing is to protect society and contribute, along with crime prevention initiatives, to the respect for law and the maintenance of a just, peaceful, and safe society by imposing just sanctions that have one or more of the following objectives. Okay, so far so good. First, to denounce unlawful conduct, etc. Sub B, to deter the offender and other persons from committing offenses. And again, I'll circle back to that later. To separate offenders from society when necessary. Well, if people are particularly dangerous, it may be necessary. D, to assist in rehabilitating offenders. Again, a very good thing. E, to provide reparations for harm done to victims and the community. And again, we're looking at a basically a situation where we would be providing, making the community whole again, also a good thing. And F, to provide a sense of responsibility in offenders and acknowledgement of the harm done to the victims and the community. So those are what Parliament has told us. Criminal justice, generally speaking, is a rather blunt instrument with which to effect change. Either specific behavioral change at an offender level, or social change on a macro or a societal level. Achieving the same by what we lawyers refer to either by specific or general deterrence. Employing a therapeutic approach to criminal justice attempts to depart from this crime and punishment model. It attempts instead to seek to influence change to the underlying factors that lead to the antisocial or offending behavior. Now, the question of whether this is something that a criminal justice system is best equipped to do is a question that is being posed by some, but an issue that I'd like to leave for another day. The therapeutic approach to criminal justice is not a completely new one. It's been utilized in several U.S. courts for some years. There's been a particular proliferation of therapeutic courts in the U.S. to deal with epidemic drug use and arguably draconian legislative response to same. So this is not something that is certainly unique or new here. In Saskatchewan, is what I'd like to address the situation in Saskatchewan. That's where I have the most knowledge. Therapeutic courts have been targeted to three areas. First, domestic violence. They're operating in Regina, Saskatoon, and the Battlefords. To drug treatment, both in Regina and Moose Jaw, and to mental health courts operating in Regina and Saskatoon. And again, I'm going to get more specific than that. I'm going to focus on the Regina courts. I know them best. So first, domestic violence court. Established in Regina in 2008. It deals with violence against intimate partners or possibly others who may be in the context. It deals with threats of violence and damage to property of the intimate partner and possibly breaches of orders ancillary to those charges. I think before we go on into precisely what the court does, an examination of some of the statistical background in terms of what is happening in family violence in Canada and in this area. So in 2016, the Juristat Police Reported Family Violence Incident Report has some statistics in that regard. And the numbers are per 100,000 in population in any given year. So the Canadian average for number of police-reported family violent incidents is 239 per 100,000. In Saskatchewan, the rate is 498, which is Saskatchewan's highest among the provinces. Prince Edward Island is lowest at 135, Ontario following very closely at 148. The territories have the highest rates, Nunavut being approximately five times what the rate is in Saskatchewan. Interestingly, there are significant differences between rural and urban settings, rural settings being about twice as high in terms of reported incidents as urban Canada. There are also significant differences in terms of the urban areas or the CMEs across Canada. Ottawa being the lowest at 85 per year, Saguenay, Quebec being the highest at 330. The reported incidence in Regina was 199, and Saskatoon was 212, about midway through the pack. Again, there is data that deals with who is being victimized, and that data would seem to indicate that females are victimized at a rate of about twice what males are. So we'll get back to the Regina Domestic Violence Court. It's a high-volume court dealing with about as many as 850 cases in any given year. It is a partnership of a number of groups, including the Provincial Court of Saskatchewan, Prosecutions, Saskatchewan Legal Aid, Victim Services, the Regina Qu'Appelle Health Region, now the Saskatchewan Health Agency, Mental Health Services, Addiction Services, and again in cooperation with Regina Municipal Police and the RCMP F Division. The philosophy of domestic violence court is that a therapeutic and multidisciplinary approach to domestic violence is best. The court mandates a coordinated approach to delivery of treatment and services to offenders in the court. The way it works is that all domestic violence matters are directed by police to a specific domestic violence courtroom. Again, all complainants are offered the services of the Victim Services Branch. All accused have access to Legal Aid Saskatchewan services by way of advice and advocacy, regardless of income level. Again, that ends when standard eligibility criteria are applied, if and when a not guilty plea is entered. So we at Legal Aid will provide advice and advocacy for anyone who is accepting responsibility and entering guilty pleas. But if, again, there is to be a not guilty plea in a trial, then eligibility criteria would be applied. Qualifying accused, again, if they are admitting responsibility, will be offered a treatment option in exchange for reduced and a certain sentence. So the treatment option, the treatment options for males generally would take about 4 to 6 months and are delivered by probation services and mental health professionals. And include individual and group counseling, and if required may include addiction services. Again, there is a treatment option for female offenders, and the program is a little shorter, generally running in the 2 to 4 month range, depending on where one gets into the program. And it is delivered by the Circle Project, who is a local NGO in Regina. And again, has a similar treatment model and object, but tends to be geared more to the needs of female offenders. And again, addiction services are available if warranted. It is not mandatory. Treatment is not mandatory. And certainly anyone may plead not guilty and put the crown to the strict proof of the allegations against them, as they could in any court, and also can simply enter a guilty plea and be sentenced in the usual course. The most recent stats, which go back to 2016, from the Regina Domestic Violence Court show that over the past several years, between two-thirds and three-quarters of the domestic violence treatment option participants completed treatment successfully. So that's is in a nutshell what is being done in regard to domestic violence. I want to go on then to the second therapeutic court that we have involvement in, and that being the drug treatment court, the Regina Drug Treatment Court. It was established in 2006. And it is designed for persons who have committed offenses as a result of or to support a drug, and I say other than alcohol, a drug habit. It would be open to those committing offenses, but not violent offenses. Again, no drug dealing above the street drug level. And again, for persons that the Crown is taking a position on sentence of between 6 and 30 months incarceration. The partnership there is between the Provincial Court of Saskatchewan, prosecutions, probation, the Saskatchewan Health Agency, Mental Health, Addiction Services, Saskatchewan Legal Aid, and the Salvation Army. Participants in this program, this court program, participate in an intensive program of counseling and treatment over a period of 12 or more months. They proceed through three stages of treatment and are given increasing privileges and freedoms as they continue through the program. For many of the participants, residence is provided by the Salvation Army, for men at Waterston House and for women at Kate's Place, certainly in the early stages of the treatment, and for some of the participants throughout the treatment program. Among the treatment tools being utilized is a technique known as moral recognition therapy, or MRT, which is a cognitive behavioral change approach to changing behavior. Research in the U.S. has indicated very positive outcomes in drug treatment court settings. At the conclusion of the course of the drug treatment court, it would be expected that most offenders would be released on some sort of community-based sentence. This court is a fairly small court and has a capacity at any time of about 30 participants. The successful graduation rate in this court is significantly lower than that in the domestic violence court. Finally, just a brief overview of Regina Mental Health Court. This was established in 2013. It's well known that significant number of persons subject to short-term incarceration suffer from significant cognitive capacity issues. It is therefore the focus of this therapeutic court to focus on particular needs and issues faced by this group. And these are issues that often the other courts are not well equipped to deal with. This court sees significant numbers of persons with both congenital and cognitive issues, as well as those with acquired brain injury. FASD is a common challenge in this court. Again, the partners involved here are provincial court, Crown prosecutions, legal aid, probation, the Saskatchewan Health Authority, as well as some community-based services, particularly the Regina Community Clinic. I think that it is best sort of to use a couple of examples in terms of folks that we would see there and situations that we would see. I use the example of a serial shoplifter from the 7-Eleven. And so this fellow would go in, and he'd steal a bag of chips. The clerk would phone the police, and the man would be seen in the parking lot a few paces outside of the 7-Eleven eating the bag of chips. And when this happened for the third or fourth or fifth time, the courts begin to lose patience. You haven't learned anything from what you've done. And again, when we drilled into that, it was quite clear this man was suffering from, you know, significant cognitive impairment. That was something that that the mental health court was certainly alive to, and the court was not sort of hands tied in terms of escalating sentences. Another fairly common scenario is persons, I would refer them to them as serial breachers of conditions and failing to attend court. And so, again, courts tend to get rather impatient with people who simply persistently refuse to obey orders or refuse to attend court, and sanctions begin to escalate to short jail terms, to longer jail terms, etc. Again, when we drill into what is actually happening, often we'll find that someone sort of appears into docket court when we may have 100 or more matters on the bench. Things are going very, very quickly. And dates and places and times are all being thrown around, and conditions are being agreed to and imposed, etc. And we have people that, although they are nodding generally that they understand, it's pretty obvious that they are not. And one of the things that mental health court does is that it operates at a much slower pace than the regular. And again, one of the issues is providing support to participants to ensure that they can obey their conditions, and secondly, that they can get to court. It is often not a situation where someone intends to be breaching their conditions, but they simply do not understand them and are not organized enough to get back to court. Again, the Regina Mental Health strategy is a court that has been resourced largely by its partners. And by that, I mean it has been done largely off the corner of the desk of a particular judge, a particular prosecutor, and a particular legal aid lawyer. And again, services have been donated by a number of community organizations, and again, I point particularly to the Regina Community Clinic, particularly with regard to FAS issues. In closing, each of the therapeutic courts has been able to step out of the 718B deterrence model. And this is a model that many scholars as well as many practitioners are questioning. Whether in fact sanctions do deter either the offender that is being sentenced or offenders or the public generally to prevent offending. But there is, I think, little doubt that for the groups that which are the subject of the therapeutic courts, the deterrence model is even more dubious in its efficacy. Overall, it's the goal of the therapeutic courts to provide some measure of accountability of offenders, along with some hope for a reduced incident of recidivism. importance as well as maintaining the public confidence in the administration of justice. And that is something that, again, we cannot lose sight of. We must all be have some confidence that, in fact, the administration of justice is being done in a fair and efficacious way. Again, that is a very brief overview of therapeutic courts as they are operating here in this province and in this city, and some of the context under which they are operating. There may be questions.
How many questions do I get? One per customer. Let me think then. Why is alcoholism not included in drug treatment court?
That's a good question. I think that it has been targeted at a number of drugs. The issues in terms of opiates, of cocaine, particularly, and of crystal meth, they have specific issues, and that is that the cost of the drugs is what is driving the offending. In other words, most people cannot make enough money legitimately to feed their habit. So what's happening is that there is offending, there's property offending, people are stealing things here and there to feed their habit, or they're dealing drugs to feed their habit. That's why it's they're seen as different than alcohol.
As I make my way over, I'll just remind everyone that if you have a question or comment, please put your hand up.
Yes, I want to address the matter of restitution, and it doesn't seem to be used very much. We put people in jail instead, and so after spending a year or two in jail, he's said to have paid his debt to society. Now, this is the strangest form of accounting that I can see, because a liability is added to a liability to obtain an asset. And I just wonder if... I just think that the jails are used way too much in place of restitution. Now, this matter of drugs, I think, has gotten totally out of hand. In my experience, they don't seem to be going after the dealers. And they... I've known all kinds of people who are on their drugs, fentanyl and crystal meth and whatnot, and so they're incapable of holding a job because of that. And then I knew one guy, he made his living by selling stolen tools, and he was a tenant of mine, so I got to know him quite well. And anyway, my question would be, why aren't they? Well, two questions: using the matter of restitution a little more, and then going after the drug dealers a little more.
So if we want to talk about the situation of an addict, one of the things there's two ways, generally speaking, that persons addicted to drugs are getting their getting money to support their habits. Number one is by dealing drugs on the street. That's very, very common. And secondly is by stealing things. Certainly, where it is possible, the courts are looking to get restitution orders. The problem is, in many cases, that it is simply not realistic, that a person, can provide, you know, full restitution to the people who he has harmed, or he or she has harmed. In a situation where you've got someone who is, you know, seriously addicted to some substance, it's likely simply not possible. It's seen as the drug treatment course strategy is to see if we can deal with that underlying cause and prevent any future harm.
Oh, I see one more hand.
You mentioned about drugs, but even when they're in prison, my daughter-in-law was a warden at the women's prison in Edmonton. And she said, even there, you could not keep drugs out of the prison. They always became in. They came in somehow, you know, through someone would bring them in.
There's no doubt that prisons, the drugs in prisons. There's no doubt about that. Again, they come in via different ways.
Domestic violence, how large a proportion of the cases are related to fetal alcohol syndrome?
And in that court, I don't think there's a tremendously high number. That court is a court where it absolutely runs the gamut in terms of people's situations, young, middle-aged, old, and of virtually every socioeconomic group imaginable. You can meet, frankly, just about anyone there. That's my experience in domestic violence court, and the patterns are really not there.
It seems to me, and I'll admit my biases right now. I'm a lefty. I'll admit it. My idea of a model for prison would be what some people would call coddling. And what our prisons do in our country is more punitive. You don't want to be in prison. That's the model, you know, like you want to stay out of prison, so be good, don't steal, or we'll send you to prison. And my idea of a prison is a place that you'd actually have... You'd almost want to be there because you're going to learn something. You're not going to get into trouble because there's supervision there. You're going to learn skills. The problems that you have are going to be dealt with. And when you come out of there, you're going to be more ready to actually live in a society where the way prisons work today, when you come out of prison, you've got nothing. You maybe have got some kind of education. You probably have very little money, very little prospects. Nobody is interested in hiring you. And it's not a positive experience. So if we want to reduce recidivism, I think I said that right, then we want to treat these prisoners like human beings and give them opportunities to get themselves out of that cycle. And, of course, this will cost money, and that's what the government doesn't want to do is spend money. That's my comment, and I'd like to hear your comment.
The follow-up on that is the issue with deterrence is particularly this. I think any rational person would generally want to stay out of the Canadian prison system, no doubt about that. But the problem is that that's people that are thinking rationally. Now, when you've been drinking and get into a violent situation, when you've been using drugs, when you are in a heightened situation where you're simply not thinking, that is when most of crimes are committed. Where deterrence is likely to work is for white-collar criminals. When we're actually sitting down and working out what's my profit versus what's my risk, that is not the calculation that is generally being made in regard to any violent crime or one in, you know, 100 is it ever being made. So the problem is the model works so long as everyone's thinking. The problem is that almost no one is thinking before they're committing a violent crime.
I've seen two other hands, and I want to accommodate each of you, but I'm going to ask you both please to be brief.
My concern is, and it's just a statement, is how the alcohol really upsets me, how they'll have for the drugs. And you've made an explanation. However, I'm wondering, in domestic violence, how much is precipitated in alcoholism? Like, is there any statistics, or do you see a lot of women being battered when a partner is in an alcoholic rage or has an alcoholic history of alcoholism? And in the domestic one, can that domestic court say you to the person that you have to go to a treatment for alcoholism?
Again, simply my experiences in that court, and I fresh off an 8-week stint there, is that it is very common that again alcohol is involved in incidents. It is very, very common. Whether there be an addiction or you know, someone was simply drunk, or in more occasions, everyone was drunk. It's very common, and that is why addiction services provide someone at the court. Often, what's happened is that people are being referred from mental health services to addiction services as a result. The problem with making anything mandatory is that there has to be a desire to change. So you can make available services, but obviously until that person is going to make that commitment to that, it's mm-hmm. difficult.
Thank you. And our last question.
I'm really concerned about prevention. I mean, Saskatchewan's in the worst situation for family violence and other kinds of violence, as I understand it. Where is... seriously, we only have two safe houses? Like, really? In Regina? That's it? And Waterston, we've talked before about, you know, it's become a target for the drug dealers. What about the women's shelter? I mean, is that the only?
There's in terms of shelters. Again, what I see from my practice in domestic violence court is that the number of circumstances in which a shelter would actually be used are fairly limited. There are often better options available, including removing the offender from the home. So instead of taking the offender, removing the offender from the home. Well, they are required to stay away. There's a court order that says that they will not attend, and that's the issue. So, There are some circumstances in which safe houses would be used, but as I say, those are fairly limited from what I see. And it would be preferable not to displace the victims from their home, but rather to displace the offender. And that's generally the approach that's being taken. I think my time is at an end.
Oh, thank you, Jamie.